psicoterapeuta, hoje eu acho que eu estou sem a mão, hein?
Hold on,
who's gonna watch? This is dead. And I'll never watch. Is that accurate? Who's got a cell phone? What's a cell phone time? Huh? Cell phone time. 12:09. Okay, that's right then.
Goody. All right. So now we try this. Okay. Let's see if that works. We're a little underpopulated today. What happens? Too cold for folks? Okay. You say to yourself, oh no, Professor Bush is going to show us movies again. God help us. Come on. Do you like the movies or you don't like the movies? Jill!
What?
You like the movies or you don't like the movies?
I like the movies.
Okay, good. I'm glad to hear that. But do you like the ones I'm showing you, Jill?
Yeah.
What are we watching today?
You'll see. You'll see what it's all a surprise, right? It's all surprises. I got no volume. Why don't I have volume? There's supposed to be audio, yes. Supposed to be audio here.
Crash.
Oh, I see. There's a function. Smart man. I like smart guys. Thank you very much.
No problem.
You're off. I'm on. This is on, right?
Yes.
This is on? Okay. Okay, so I see we have bunches of stragglers today, so I won't take attendance yet.
Mary Ann wrote me a little note about what I'd said about my empowerment story, right? So I might, if we can, I'm going to get to that at the end of class. Would you remind me? About 10 minutes from the end of class, remind me. In case I'm interested in that. I hope your assignments are going well. I look forward to reading your papers and to seeing you a week from today, even though it's the eve of Thanksgiving. I'm going to be here. I will take it very personally if you're not. I always do. So, now, we started talking last week after having spent a long time talking about what is an empowerment shift all about? What does it involve? Why is it something that matters to people? We started talking about what does the transformative, what do you do in the transformative model, since that's what you're trying to accomplish, not to produce a settlement, to make sure everybody's needs and interests get met. What do you do to support an empowerment shift? And we got a little bit into that. I'm going to come back to practices, but we basically said there's the don'ts and the do's. The don'ts are you don't control, you don't stifle emotion, you don't stop it from what's in the past, you don't. With me, Joe. Please be with me, okay? And on the other hand, you do things that support but don't supplant party decision making, because when people make decisions, they regain a sense of strength and competence and control, which is the definition of an empowerment. And therefore, you never want to supplant that, no matter what the decision is about, no matter how seemingly trivial it's about, and no matter how important it is. So if it would be a trivial decision about where to sit in a room, it's still a decision. It would be an enormous decision about whether or not to talk about race, it's still a decision. And neither of those decisions is going to be supplanted, because by doing so, you would further disempower those parties. You would add insult to injury, since they're already sensing that they're incompetent and capable of handling, you would only make it worse by reinforcing that, saying, yeah, you really are. I need to be the one who controls it. And then we said, those are don'ts, but then there are do's. So how can you support an empowerment shift? How can you help people? Which means, if you think about it, how can you help people get calmer and clearer and more organized and more articulate and more decisive? That's all the sub
definitions of an empowerment shift.
So one answer is you can help them simply by reflecting what they say to them.
Not carrying messages back and forth, but
by just reflecting what people say. We talked a little bit about why that works, even though it's very simple, although it's quite difficult to do. Those of you, a few of you are taking the January skills course. There's also a skills course offered in May. If you can't take it in January, for credit. Not for credits, but for credit. You're welcome to sign up for that, too. It'll be the week after graduation, the week of May 18th, in case you're interested. But it's actually quite hard to practice that skill in a disciplined way. But the effect of it is to give the person, in the middle of this very difficult conversation, their own sort of private space to talk to themselves, to externalize their thoughts, and thereby take control of them. And, in effect, decide what they want to think and what they want to say. They don't want to say. They don't want to think. Those are some of the most important decisions that we make in life. How to express ourselves. What to say, how to say it, when to say it, who to say it to, and not. And you do that by serving as this mirror that reflects what people are saying to them and doing it with one person at a time. And then, also, we said that we leaders can support a partnership by summarizing a chunk of the conversation by just pointing out to people what they have been talking about and where they disagree. Because people lose track of it in a conversation that's very fast and angry and upset. They lose track of what they're talking about. And that, of course, if you don't know what you're talking about, are you in or out of control? You're out of control, right? You're thrashing. You're flailing. So by stepping in at appropriate points to summarize, a mediator can help people to regain, again, a sense of, oh, I'm in control of this conversation, I know where we are in it, and I can decide where we want to go next. And then mediators can support parties' sense of control by actually giving them control, by checking in and asking them, what do you want to do? Where do you want to go next? What is it that you want to talk about? Do you want to end the session at this point? And you see Bush in the Purple House ask that question at a couple of different points. Do you want to take a time out? All of those kinds of check-ins turn over control, and that's constantly what a mediator is doing in this model. Instead of keeping control, because mediator control is the sort of fundamental principle of facilitative mediation, and even of restorative mediation, though it's used for different purposes, giving up control is the fundamental principle. Turning over control is the fundamental principle of transformative mediation. So those are some of the practices. And then also we talked about the practice of knowing when to get out of the way. And instead of wanting to step in between the parties and interrupt the flow of their conversation, especially when it gets angry and hot, the transformative mediator learns to step out of the way and sit there and not be frightened, nonplussed, terrified when the parties are in direct engagement with each other. So we talked about each of those practices, there is a logic to how it supports, not directly anyway, the production of a settlement or a wise settlement. Because that's not the purpose. But rather, it supports empowerment shifts and recognition shifts. And the purpose, and why is that important? Because that's the premise. That's what we're trying to accomplish. That's our goal. That's my mission. Will that also wind up helping people to find their way to agreements, to settlements that they actually think are good for them? The answer is yes, it will. Whenever there are terms on which they can actually agree. And where they can't, it'll help them to articulate more clearly what it is they disagree about and what it is they have to do next about that disagreement and how it's possible to do it in a fashion that doesn't feel to either person either helpless or hateful. So that's the nature, that's the relationship of this to agreement. Now, all of that was about empowerment shifts. What about recognition shifts? Because the model says what happens to people with negative conflict is that they fall into a state of experiencing themselves as helpless, weak, incompetent, but also alienated, hostile, and hateful towards the other person. And the transformation of the conflict interaction involves both shifts out of, both the shift out of weakness to strength, and out of self-absorption and hatefulness to responsiveness and openness to the other party. Why is that
Why is that important, first of all? I mean, in terms of the transformative theory, why is the recognition shift important to people? So in other words, we said, well, the empowerment shift is important to people, at least the theory is, because the experience for people of being helps them out of control and tossed to and fro by life or by this particular point in life is a very unpleasant and disturbing and distressing experience. We don't want to feel like we're lost, out of control, dependent. We want and have a need to feel like we're autonomous agents in control of our own life, as it says in chapter 2. And the empowerment shift is what helps us to regain that sense of autonomy and control and competency and agency. But what about the recognition shift? Why is that important to people? So what? Now I feel, hey, and you're writing about empowerment shifts right now, which I will get your papers by Saturday night. Some of you have already sent me. Thank you very much. But what about recognition shifts? Why is that important to me? Okay, look, I made an empowerment shift. Now I don't feel out of control anymore. I feel like a strong person in control of my own life. What does that have to do with... So fine, that's enough. Now let's go on. What do I need? What's the... The theory says, no. First of all, that's not enough to get you through the conflict cycle. But more importantly, recognition shifts also matter to people. Now, Larry, you remember the restorative justice mediator? He thought that too. He was in the hate reduction business, right? A recognition shift is hate reduction, if you want to look at it that way. It's going from hateful to responsive or appreciative. Very different, right? Well, Larry was in that business, right? So what's the difference between Larry and Bush? Bush is also interested in recognition shifts. Hate reduction. What's the difference between Larry and Bush, between a transformative and a restorative mediator? As, what do you think? You're smiling, Brad.
You know the answer to this question?
Or you have an answer?
No, that's what I'm talking about.
Okay. Well.
Okay, anybody have an answer? Do you remember Larry? Do you remember how he pursued the goal of hate reduction? You know, what's the difference?
He directed it, he controlled it, and under the transformative model, they control the process, and they get to control it.
Okay, and so another way of saying that is Larry was not concerned about weakness reduction. Larry was not concerned about empowerment shifts. He was concerned about recognition shifts, but he was perfectly happy to produce them by force, by manipulation. And he did. And it can be done. Bush doesn't do that. So Bush is also interested in hate reduction, but only when it is based upon choice. When it's based upon choice, and not when it's forced or pushed or coerced. You're frowning, Brad. Do you get the difference between those two things? And, well, why would Bush, or anybody for that matter, be so... That's, again, the point of your assignment this week, and I gave you that supplemental thing to talk about. Why is the focus on empowerment shifts so strong in the way I present this? Did you read that supplemental memo that I wrote to you? If not, read it, because it talks about this. Why is Bush not willing to be Larry? Yeah, what's the answer to that? Is there an answer to that? Why isn't he just, okay, look, I know how to manipulate people into caring about each other more and hating each other less. Why shouldn't I do that? Why should I have to worry about the empowerment shift coming first, which is the name of that article, that the thing I gave you to read for this week, that supplemental memo, not for this week, but the thing that was attached to your writing assignment, that's what it's from, an article entitled First, If Not Foremost, The Centrality of the Empowerment Shift. Why is it first, if not foremost, according to Bush? Because recognition, coerced recognition shifts, Bush believes, aren't real, aren't sustainable, any more than a settlement imposed upon the parties by manipulation is not sustainable, isn't going to last. So a recognition shift imposed upon the parties, produced by party manipulation, is also not going to last. For the moment, people will see each other's point of view. But since they didn't come to it on their own, in their own way, in their own time, and aren't ready for it, can't really internalize it, in essence. So it's going to come and go. But if they come to it themselves and they really decide, yeah, I don't want to see this person in this hateful way anymore. I really don't. And I'm making that choice. Me, myself, and I in a strong, competent place, then that's gonna have much more permanence, much more lasting sustainability. So Bush cares about the sustainability of the shift, not just the temporary occurrence of it, right? So therefore, Bush is worried about empowerment, not just recognition. But why is he worried about recognition anyway? Coming back to that. What does he care about that? So the answer to that briefly is, and I want to see if you can identify with this too. I didn't ask you to think about recognition shifts that you've made in difficult conflicts, but it's usually easier for people to think about that and to imagine those, like where we've really come to forgive somebody or let go of our anger about something that someone did to us. But in the theory of transformative conflict, the reason that people care about recognition shifts is because their sense of themselves, their sense of their own identity, our sense of our own identity, and again, this is talked about in Chapter 2, and it's also talked about in Chapter 7, which I'd like you to read for next week, Chapter 7, for next week, the last chapter of the book. And in both of those chapters, it talks about the notion that our core human identity is a sort of duality. That on the one hand, our identity, what is an identity? Our sense of who we are. Not as men or women or African Americans or whites or Jews or Christians. Our sense of ourselves in terms of who we are as human beings is A, that we are autonomous agents of our own lives. We're not just tossed around by fate. We're subjects, not objects. But also, and together with that, that we are subjects who are essentially connected to other subjects. We are strong agents essentially connected to the other people around us. Not because we need their friendship, not out of a need to satisfy ourselves, but out of the essence of our identity. A human being who is totally strong, autonomous. Anybody ever read Atlas Shrugged? Ayn Rand, who's experiencing somewhat of a comeback these days. A human being, what was the guy's name? Galt or something like that? John Galt, the hero of Atlas Shrugged. It was a cult novel in the 60s and 50s. A person who's absolutely strong and totally unconcerned about others. Not meaning that he doesn't bring them around to satisfy various needs, but he doesn't really care about them. That's an incomplete person, because the nature of human identity is that it involves both a sense of our own strength and a sense of our inherent, not just instrumental, our inherent connection to other human beings. So if we lose touch with our own sense of our own strength, we lose touch with our sense of who we are. When we're weak, when we're floundering, we are not ourselves. But equally so, when we are alienated and possessed by hatefulness towards someone else, we also sense, this isn't who I am. I can't live with myself if that's the state that I'm in. So on page 60, again, it says there, this is the basic sense, that there is, the premise here is, which the book calls the relational view of human nature. In other words, there's a theory of human nature underlying this theory of conflict, which we'll talk about more next week, which Chapter 7 talks more about. There's a theory of human nature underlying the other theories of mediation as well. They're just different theories. And you may hold one of them rather than the other. Right now I'm trying to explain this particular approach. So this theory says at the top of page 60, there's a basic human nature or identity common to all people. So this is imperialistic theory. It says this is independent of culture, independent of history, independent of anything. This is what human beings are. And their sense of their identity is a dual sense of both individual autonomy and social connection. As a matter of basic human consciousness, every person senses that he or she is a separate autonomous agent, and at the very same time, an inherently social being connected to others in an essential, not just an instrumental fashion. Not just, I need you, I want you to rub my back, to make me not feel lonely, to make me feel wanted. No, I feel that I am connected to you because I am a being that part of my identity is to connect to you. And therefore, this dual identity means that I am distressed not only when I fall into weakness, but also when I fall into hatefulness. And the experience of either of those, weakness or hatefulness, is an intolerable experience, is an experience that I want to get out of. There's a basic impulse, in other words, to make empowerment shifts and recognition shifts. So if I would be feeling weak and selfish, I would have an impulse to get out of both of those things. If I get out of the first, now I feel strong, but I still am an experience that I can't see beyond the end of my own nose. At some deep level, I am continuing to exist in a state of alienation from myself. I can't stand it until I can make that recognition shift as well. On the other hand, if I somehow have been persuaded, coerced, lulled by you to make a recognition shift, in other words, so now, you know, I really do understand Brad. It's hard, but I do. And, however, that understanding has been force-fed into me. So I still feel basically shredded in my own sense of control. But I understand Brad. So that sense, in other words, of weakness, so you can have strength and selfishness, and you can have weakness and understanding. One way of understanding that state of mind is the state of mind of a cult member. A cult member who is devoted to a leader, but without any sense of their own separate autonomous choice. I've given up my choice. I'm totally devoted. But, on the other hand, I don't have any sense of self. Both of those experiences, utter strength and utter self-interest, and utter weakness and utter devotion within this model would be considered truncated experiences of our human identity. Our human identity is both a sense of strong self connected to other. Now, we saw that last week, right? Some of you actually pointed that out. You pointed that out, as a matter of fact, either Brad or Adam. I don't remember which one of you. We said, what's amazing about this guy, Nick, how do you pronounce his last name? Vujicic. What's amazing about it? Or maybe it was Kiwan that pointed it out. It's not just the way he picked himself up, literally, right? He, not just in that video, but in his life, right? He transcended, he shifted out of weakness, but then one of you said what? The amazing thing was, he didn't just, you know, okay, now I'm going to go make $1 million. He devoted himself, has devoted his entire life, to motivating other people who, with disabilities, without hands and feet, literally. His organization is called Life Without Limbs. It's specifically to help other people. So what is it that forces him? Okay, he overcame his limitations. But now, that's not enough for him. He has to then give something to other people, right? That's the impulse of the recognition shift. That's the impulse to achieve the full version of human identity that includes both strength and connection, both autonomy and responsiveness to others. The person who lacks either one of those essentially is incomplete, according to this theory. By the way, this theory, you say, where do you get this, Professor Bush? This theory is, as the book describes, surfaces in a lot of different places. Where I specifically got this from, might be of interest to some of you, was actually from a feminist theorist named Carol Gilligan, who is an educational an expert in moral theory and moral development. Have you ever, any of you heard of Jean Piaget? Piaget is more familiar to most people. He's a developmental psychologist who developed the whole theory of how children learn and the stages of learning for children. There is, just as there's a theory of educational development, there's a theory of moral development. At what stage do human beings become capable of moral judgment? And all the philosophers and social scientists who studied that prior to Gilligan basically understood moral development in terms of the autonomy dimension, the empowerment shift. When we're young and immature, we are basically totally influenced by peer pressure. We want everybody to love us. We don't have any sense of our own self-generated values. And moral development involves generating a sense of self-directed values, moral autonomy, autonomy of choice. So I'm going to do what I think is right, independent of my environment. That's considered the development of moral maturity up to Gilligan. As a result of that, interestingly, many studies were done that suggested that women in general, not all women, but women in general were sort of stuck in an arrested state of moral development. Because women always seemed to be concerned with what other people thought. And that would always be taken into consideration in their judgments. Gilligan came and said, you don't understand. That's true, but you don't understand what it means. It doesn't mean that women are stunted in their moral development. It means that there's another side to moral development that has nothing to do with the development of autonomy, but rather has to do with the development of a sense of connection and concern and care for others. Women happen to be, on the whole, much better at developing that side of moral maturity than men. Men happen to be, on the whole, find it easier to develop the autonomy side of moral maturity. But both of those sides are half the picture. And full moral development includes what Gilligan calls the integration of the ethic of justice, which is autonomy, what's right, what do I think is right, and the ethic of care, what's important for me to be able to connect to this other person. Human beings that live in one of those two dimensions rather than the other are morally stunted, whether they're men or women, in whatever dimension it is. That's what Gilligan's work was about. Her work was, for many people, mind-blowing in the early 1980s, and for me, it made tremendous sense, and I began to see how it fit together with the development of a theory of mediation. And that's really the most significant intellectual foundation of this theory. Now, there are lots of other theorists, as I discovered, who have similar views and root them in something other than the theory of moral development. There are political scientists, there are sociologists, there are lots of folks in other disciplines, but that's one of the main influences. So when I'm telling you this stuff, it's not like coming out of my head. It is coming out of my head, but it's connected to other things as well. So this is why the recognition shift matters to people. This is why giving, and recognition is giving recognition to the other person, not getting it from them. The recognition shift is not, oh, now you understand me. No. The recognition shift is, oh, now I understand you. That's a recognition shift. And the reason it matters is because giving to others, so, you know, like our moms taught us, which is, they're always right, turns out, is as important as, or more so than getting ourselves. But when is it important? When we really do give to them. When can you give something to somebody else? When you're standing four square on your own feet. Even if you don't have feet. Like Nick Vujicic. So the recognition shift matters too. Now, what does a recognition shift look like? That's what I want to talk about now. Just like, I want to do the same sort of thing we did with empowerment shifts. We tried to get a clear sense of what does an empowerment shift look like? Why does it matter? And how would you, as a mediator, support it in a conflict? Although empowerment shifts can occur without conflicts. So, picture, why it matters, how you support it. I want to do the same thing with recognition shifts. And to do it, I want to use, again, a clip from this film, Crash. This is also a wrenching, give you a little heads up here. Anyway, I think it is a wrenching kind of clip, but it's very, very different. Let me set it up for you. We know that from the previous clip that Cameron, the director, had been thrown into his state of weakness by this, originally anyway, by this confrontation with two cops, one of whom was a racist pig, who sexually assaulted his wife in front of him while he was forced to stand helpless and watch and or be shot. And the subsequent scenes, Cameron descends further into this until he begins to climb out of it with that scene that we watched. And in that scene, the white cop who engages with Cameron stood by, also, in a sense, disempowered by this racist cop, by being forced to watch someone do something, as he was a junior cop and this guy was a sergeant, that was absolutely disgusting, and he could do nothing about it. So he also, both he and Cameron, had been thrown into this state of disempowerment, right? And in the scene where they meet again, interestingly, they both get out of that and come back to some sense of making their own choices. Now, this scene that I'm about to show you involves the racist cop. This racist cop, as we see in other parts of the film, he definitely does racist things. He may indeed be a racist. But we see more about him in the film, including that his father is suffering from some sort of probably bladder cancer, which the health HIP, the health plan, won't treat him for. And he is living with his father, seeing his father really die in front of his own eyes, and associates that with, has this whole racist theory of how black people get everything and white people get nothing. And it so happens that his most recent encounter before this sexual assault on Cameron's wife is with a black woman who is the claims administrator at the HIP who denies treatment for his father. So, you know, he generalizes this and decides to take it out on Cameron and Cameron's wife. Now, this is the racist cop. We're coming up to another scene here. This scene involves, again, him and the woman who he assaulted, the wife of Cameron, who he had assaulted on the street. And this cop now goes out on a job. At the beginning of this scene, the very beginning of this scene, actually, let me see if I can show you just the first moment of this scene. Find my notes as to where we are. At the beginning of this scene, the young cop has asked to be reassigned. He can't stand the idea of working with this guy anymore. And so he's asked to be reassigned. As he comes out to his car and tells the racist cop that he's not going to work with anymore, the racist cop says goodbye to him. And then he says to him, as we'll see at the beginning of the scene, he confronts him a little bit because he knows how the young white cop feels about him. He knows that he thinks he's a pig and a racist. And let's just hear what he says at that point. Hang on. There's the young guy. He's coming up to the racist Sergeant Parker. You think you know who you are, you have no idea. All right, just keep that in mind. We're going to advance this a little bit. Okay, this is just a lead up. Now starts our scene. After this little step.
here comes the car with the racist cop in it. He's about to see who this is. And who this is the woman that he sexually assaulted.
Oh!
So let's talk about that scene for a minute.
What is the look that they give each other at the end of that scene? What does that look say? What does it express? Is that what she's saying?
That's what it looks like. She nodded her head finally.
Right. Okay, let's hear all your different readings. That's why film is so nice. Yeah, what is...
I think she's nodding her head because she's like, she can't believe it. She thinks he doesn't want to face her.
Anna?
I also think that she would run around the car faster if it had been Cobb, but because it was him, she's obviously not going to want to trust him. So, in a very long chain of events, him assaulting her kind of led to putting her at an increased risk of danger.
And what is the look again? What is that look? By the way, she looks and he looks. I'm asking you both. What does her look say? What does his look say? That's all true what you just said. But if you're focusing on her, so what does her look say? Okay, interesting. Okay. Kiwan, let's just go around. Yep, Kiwan?
I think it was like he was sort of hope from whatever animosity he had as far as that moment, from that hatred she had and the very beginning scene.
Yeah.
So went away.
I want you to just stop for a minute and think. You want to see the scene again? That end of the scene? No. I want you to think, what are the words in her head when she looks back at him? What are the words in his head as he looks at her? What are the words, in other words? That's what I mean by what is the look saying? The look is an expression. Expression is saying something even if it's not in words. We attach words to it. That often happens in mediations. Looks express what something is, what's being said. So if I take what you say, and I'm asking you to be more specific. Give content to it. Content. Okay, I see you're just trying to get in there, Michelle. Go ahead.
I just think for both of them, it seems like you're not what I thought you were on both sides at the end, and her more in a sense of way. I think that I think that's just more not what, like, others to me. And then on his point, I think it's not only that she wasn't the stereotype like he saw her as a person, but also maybe saw that he wasn't who he thought he was. I think when he was saying to them, you don't really know who you are until you've been on the job, for more years. And I think that he didn't realize that was maybe true for him. He had some stereotypes that maybe had developed, but he didn't realize that he was actually a more compassionate person, so he was thankful for that.
Mm-hmm. Very nice. Maciek, what did you want to say?
I just thought that with her nodding, she was almost shaking her head and saying, how can you have done this to me previously and now be my savior?
How is that? Right. Okay. What do you want to add to that?
Well, I was saying, I think his look was more like, I'm sorry, because he realized, like, he screwed up and was taking advantage. And she just seemed, like, confused, I think, about, like, how this happened.
Okay. Anybody else want to throw something in there? Dialogue lines, bubbles. We could all put all these words in bubbles over their heads, right? That's one thing a film director does. He creates these scenes, and then people will interpret them in a lot of different ways. If we wanted to use, but why am I using this as an example of recognition? That's what this scene, that previous scene with Cameron, is mostly an empowerment shift scene. This is a recognition shift scene. And to me, anyway. And, but on the other hand, if you think about it, I mean, think of when they first, when each one first sees who the other one is. We also think about what enables a recognition shift to happen, right? So when she first sees him and sees who it is, what does she want? She's, as far as she's concerned, he's, you know, evil incarnate. Anybody but you. She knows she's, I mean, even if she doesn't know she's going to be immolated in a few seconds, but she knows she's in a pretty tough spot, right? But she's willing to stay there and be in, you know, distress. Anybody but you. I don't want to be saved by you. Why is that? Why would she say that? Why would she say that?
She's afraid
that
he's going to do the same thing. Or not do the same thing, but he's still the same person.
I don't want my rapist to be my savior. You're a rapist. You're not a savior. That's who you are. I don't want to be in the same world with you. And certainly not to have you save my life. Even if my life needs to be saved. Anybody but you. Right? And he, what's his first response to her in the scene? Okay, you want to argue with me?
I don't argue, but I don't agree. That she was empowered and allowed him to save her.
Very good, very good, very good. What does he first do before that, Brad?
Did he?
He says, "Shut up!
Yeah.
Do what I say!" And what is her response to that?
Shut up.
No. To freak out even more, to scream, to thrash. No, she doesn't shut up at that point. She starts crying.
Oh, that was
and then she says, then he says to her, okay. In other words, if you look at the scene real carefully, what he does, what would you call that? He totally lowers his voice, right? He lowers his voice, he backs off, and instead of telling her what to do, what does he do? What does he do? First of all, he tells her what the situation is. He says, I know, in effect, you don't want me to touch you, but I'm the only one here. That's gasoline. We have to get you out of here. He just tells her what the facts are. Right? And then he says, then he begins to ask permission. Can I do this? Can I do this? This is what he does. Right? He somehow makes this empowerment shift. Right? He calms down. And when he makes this empowerment shift, though, it's not just, I shouldn't say that. When he asks her these questions, what is that? That's not just an empowerment shift. That actually, I mean, it's not the empowerment shift. That's a recognition shift on his part, isn't it? Right? He says, I recognize what I did to this woman. That's your piece, Anna. I recognize what I did to you. I recognize that I'm, because of what I did before, that now means I'm putting your life more at risk now. And I see that that was wrong. Did you notice this gesture that he does when he first reaches across to undo her belt? He pulls her skirt down. This is the same hand that shoved itself up her skirt in the previous scene. It's a remarkable juxtaposition of images. And then, at every stage, he's asking her. And because he asks her, what does this enable her to do? That's right. It helps her to make an empowerment shift. Right? Yeah?
I was thinking that, that at that point he realizes that, whereas in his life before, you know, his hatred is important, this life saving is so much more important.
Right.
And he's seeing that they're, the first time in his life they're in conflict.
Right. And another way of saying that could be he sees that she's not an African American. who are all those people who get unfair advantage and made his father suffer and that oppress him. He sees that she is a human being in distress and in need. And this is his mission in life, to help other human beings. So, but she is another human being. And of course, that changes everything that he did previously. Right? That changes its meaning for him and brings home to him all of that. Right? So, in those few seconds, all of this is happening. And for her, what does she see with her empowerment shift of, yes, he's asking me questions, if you were to say, what's going on in her head? Which then culminates in that look at the end.
He's not the rapist right now.
He's not the rapist right now. Another way of saying it would be like Michelle was saying, he really isn't the rapist. He really isn't the racist sexual assaulter. That's not all that this man is. I don't understand how that fits together. That's like Machik's thing. You know, like, how does this fit? You did that and you do this. Something different is going on here. Something bigger is going on here. You're not who I thought you were. Both of them, that is what I would say is the sort of, if I had to give a tagline to the whole thing, the tagline is, you're not who I thought you were. You're not, you know, some black bitch to be fiddled with. You're not some racist white pig who knows nothing but how to hurt people, especially black people. Or at least that's not all you are. There's more to you than that. And there's more that's human to you. There's more that I can relate to and connect with in you. There's more good in you than I thought. Yeah?
These scenes, in both scenes, also for the young cop and for this cop,
mm-hmm.
It's almost like not being able to recognize the other is also part of what makes you feel helpless.
Absolutely. In other words, now going back to what Anna, what Michelle said before, it's interesting. The scene starts with him saying to the young cop, you know, you think you know what it's about. Wait until you've been on the job for a few years. Then you'll find out who you are. Now, what is the meaning of that in that statement? What is he really saying to the young cop in Michelle at the beginning?
That you'll find out that there's more
of me. Meaning, you'll realize you're seeing me as some terrible racist and I'm the only one. No, no, no. You're going to find out that you're a racist too. And that you're just as bad as me. And now, by the end of the scene, when he's like looking like, what the hell happened, basically, right? Looking at her. And there is this extraordinary... By the way, what is the cover of the video? See?
A scene that they picked for the cover of the video. It's him holding her after the scene. When he holds her like that, and she folds into his arms, and the other cops have to separate them,
and she looks back at him. But it's almost like... That's what it's meant to look like. It's almost like two lovers. And then the other cops separate them. And she looks back at him. What was that? And he looks at her. What was that? Who was that? It's an extraordinary moment of connection. But it's also a moment because of what they find not just in the other person, but like you say, in themselves. He's thinking, you mean I'm not a racist? I thought that's what I was. I'm not. My life isn't so simple. My reality includes her. And she's looking at him and saying, you mean he's not a complete pig? My reality has to change now. My reality. I'm not who I thought I was. I can't hate him anymore. How can I hate him? Or other people like him? How can I disrespect her and other people like her? In other words, everything changes there because of this shift that's a recognition shift. Right? That's a picture of a recognition shift. The interesting thing about the word recognition, if you break down the word recognition or recognize, what does it mean? Recognizing something. Cognition means perceiving, becoming aware of. What can you recognize? No. No. Literally. just analyzing what the word means. Yeah, and you lost touch with, or you weren't in touch with. You can only recognize something you already saw once. Oh, that's Brad. Hi, I recognize you. If I never met you before, how can I recognize you? If I never saw you in my life, I can meet you, but that's not called recognizing you. Recognizing you or something is when I'm seeing something again that I know, and I know that thing, but I had forgotten it. Recognition here means, and that's where he's seeing, I'm recognizing, I always knew she was a human being, but I forgot. I always knew I wasn't a racist, but I forgot. And recognizing is the bringing back of that whole deeper knowledge that surfaces again. Only when it's not pushed. You could never push someone to do that, right? Because they cling to their seatbelt, to their old place. You could say, well, but they're forced to do it here. What forces them to do it here? The circumstances, right? What's the most remarkable thing that he does in this scene? The most remarkable thing that she does is to let him help her, given what's happened. I mean, that is an extraordinary, it's not just an act of empowerment, it's an act of recognition. I am going to allow you to save my life. Really, what you deserve is to be punished with being responsible for my death, which is what would have happened if she'd resisted, right, Anna? That would be the punishment that he would live with for the rest of his life. That his original racist act caused his help to be rejected in a time of need, and he would never forget that. And she gives him, no, I'll let you help me. And what is the most remarkable thing he does? Yeah? He goes back in the car. All the other cops, and they're all cops, but they have rules, you know. And ultimately, if you can't get somebody out of the car without killing yourself, and you're in danger of imminent death, the other cops are going to pull him away. And he rips away from them and dives back into the car for her. Right? That's extraordinary, isn't it? That's like Nick Vujicic, not just helping himself. So this is a remarkable scene in not just the way each one comes to ground, empowerment shift, but the way each one then reaches out to the other. And that look at the end, and neither of them, in a way, what is the impact of a recognition shift, we could say, when you've been through it? What does it look like from that scene? The impact is, what happened? That's beyond imagination. That's not possible. How could this have happened? Given what everybody is and who everybody is, something totally supernatural happened here. Something completely out of the normal course of reality happened here. I asked you to read the excerpt from Burns for this week, right, about recognition shifts and about moral conversation. Do you remember what he says there about how moral conversation is a way in which when people engage at that level, they move to sort of a supernatural level of connection, of exchange, where it's not normal. It's not the normal course of events. And that's also, I don't know if I'm getting across what I'm trying to say here. The look there is a look of wonder. That's the word. Wonder in a positive sense. How could something this good have happened in life? That my oppressor would turn into my savior, that the woman I thought of as a dog turns out to be a human being worthy of my risking my life for. How did that happen? Life is much bigger than I thought it was. I can't imagine what is going on here. And that's also in their look. And that's also the recognition shift. And you see this in mediation rooms, believe you me, when people make this connection. This is exactly what you see. Now, let's take a break and look at it in a mediation room. Okay, it went on a little longer. You have the last word. Go ahead, say what.
Yes? Recognizing
organizing is bringing back a little bit of my knowledge that surfaces. When you say that, are you talking about their initial meeting of each other before an incident occurred?
I'm talking. I'm talking about something that they may not ever have experienced in their life. In other words, he grew up a racist from day one, right? She grew up, you know, a radical who believes that all white people are oppressors from day one. But what they are recognizing is something which they knew before anybody taught them anything, before they were born. You can't really say that. Before they were educated, before life contaminated their fundamental understanding of who they were, that resides within their basic consciousness as human beings. Nobody is born a murderer. Nobody is born a victim. That's the premise. Okay? All right, let's take a short 7-minute break and come back and see if we can turn this into a mediation discussion. But it's a hell of a clip, isn't it? Yeah. Yes, yes. There is a clip at the very end of the film. For those of you who haven't seen it, we won't spoil it. This is a DVD worth renting and seeing all the way through. Even though it's in some ways very manipulative and contrived, it is an utterly powerful exploration of exactly the issues that we're exploring.
No.
Haggis?
Yeah.
That's the one with Clint Eastwood and the woman who... Uh-huh. Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that. Interesting. Okay.
A little breath. I have a quick... what I was trying to get at is that sometimes disempowerment is... What was to not recognize...
Which we tried to get at in what?
In my comments.
Which comments
are... It doesn't matter. Let's start over.
Okay, good.
Why did he feel disempowered at the end of the race? It's because he was supposed to die.
Correct.
He was forced into that position of not recognizing.
He was forced into the complicity of denying them their humanity.
His empowerment was to recognize the director and that other stand-up. He chose to. He knew what was going on, and he recognized what was, and he chose to recognize the racial issue, etc., etc. And that was his step of empowerment. I'm not saying it always works out this way. I'm just saying that sometimes disempowerment is because you're forced to not recognize the other option.
That's that part of what's disempowering.
Right. Disempowerment and recognition separate. They're sort of spilling into each other.
Right.
That's part of the conflict that I'm exploring is it's not only a conflict between me and, you know, say, the individual, it's also it's my internal conflict. I want to recognize the human as an individual, and I can't.
You're not allowed
to be uniform for the balance.
Right.
And so.
One could say that this was also the experience of the Israeli soldiers who were in the so called disengagement.
So it works in many situations.
It doesn't matter that it was a Palestinian.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. I'm just saying this is mine.
Worse.
Right. I'm just saying this is my my personal
thing. I hear you.
Yes. So purely about this.
That's a little recognition. Well, no, what you're talking about, however, is in that part
and then that you're talking about
talking about a particular kind of disempowerment,
right,
that arises from your not having control. So, in a sense, you could say, you know, what is disempowerment? Disempowerment is a situation in which you have lost control over your choices and decisions, or where that's been taken away from you.
Right?
And you're describing a situation where the particular choice that's been taken away from you is is particularly egregious because it's a moral choice. Right. The choice has been taken away from the
individual.
How to
relate to the individual.
What?
That's a good
idea. Okay.
And that's why people like study the brutalizing effects of prison guards. That's exactly what what this is about.
That's why they don't resonate.
Then the question is, look at the way the scene unfolds, because in a way what he does, which is also a lot of the scene, is that within the limited sphere of how he can choose to treat someone, right? In one scene, he permits himself to abuse his authority.
Right.
And in another scene, he chooses to use his authority in the most, and his power in the most, not just benign, but beneficent and compassionate way. Right? So and this gives him strength as
right.
it gives her recognition.
Right.
And then at the end, as I'm saying, the thing that comes out of all of this, that the sum of empowerment and recognition is more than the parts.
Right.
Is what they're both looking at. It's not just each other. It's not just that they're looking at each other. And to me, her look up is, I can't believe this. Not you still son of a bitch, but I can't believe this. And his look is also like someone who's, you know, hit by a rocket. There is something so enormous that just happened. What was it? I never knew that this thing existed. And this thing that existed is called I have to
yes.
make a little side trip and a little visit to the men's room, and then we will continue.
Okay, let's get back to work. Now, after you shouldn't have mentioned Mike to me before, Kate, because I now notice he's not here. Maybe I would have forgotten. But the fact of the matter is, I saw him in the library. He looked a little surprised, so. But I'm sure he has a very good reason for not being here. Okay, hang on. You know what? That's the danger of being in the same building when you got class that day. You never know who's going to see you. Okay. You could tell him he can listen to the podcast, though, because I podcast for Alla because she's sick. So there is a podcast in the class that he can listen in. Okay. Well, there's a lot that could be said about this. I keep meaning to petition to extend this class to 3 hours and 3 credits instead of 2, because it's so hard to get this into 2 hours. But I don't know if all of you would take this class if it were 3 hours, right? There's a downside to extending it. So let's ask now about, just before we go into the, how do we put this in the context of mediation? And the answer is we go from the sublime to the ridiculous, from Crash to the Purple House, which is the last piece of the Purple House we're going to watch, hopefully. But I want to talk a little bit about what does a mediator do? What would a mediator do to support these kinds of shifts? What is it that helps people to make recognition shifts beyond that they come to a certain state of empowerment? That's not going to happen. In other words, that has to happen. So, in other words, if you want to help people to make empowerment recognition shifts, you have to first try to do the things that support and don't supplant decision-making and help them make empowerment shifts. But if you wanted also to say, but that's not my whole job, I want to support recognition shifts as well. Not force them, like Larry, not push them, but support them. What would that mean? How do you do that? What are the methods that a mediator would do to do that? So, you've read the handout that I gave you for today's class, I hope, this little 6-page handout. The first section of which comes from training notes that I prepared after a training class some years back. And before we look at the Purple House tape, I just want to sort of focus on those for a minute. And talk about what is it that helps to bring about a recognition shift. Then we can talk about what does a mediator do that's similar to that. And you see that what the general point of this section on the first 2.5 pages of this handout is that what begins to generate a recognition shift is when the parties to a conversation or to an encounter like this one have ceased, that something happened that makes it impossible for each one to see the other as a stick figure, as a caricature, as a stereotype, as anything other than a full human being with a full and probably unendingly deep reality of life to their life. In other words, when two people begin to become real to each other, it's almost as though if you were looking at a flat photograph and gradually that photograph turned into a hologram and gradually that hologram turned into a real person, like Star Trek, right? Beam me up, Scotty. The emergence of the other person as a full, real, undeniable human being with a real, undeniably plausible life behind whatever claim they're making, whatever face they're presenting in this encounter. This is what almost magnetically sucks out recognition. It becomes impossible to treat the other person as an object. A picture is an object. A human being is not. But most of the time, we know little enough about each other, and we see little enough about each other, even right now here in this classroom, that we are like looking each one of us at pictures of everybody else. And when that begins to be impossible, that's when we can't treat each other like that anymore. So what is it? That's what happens here in this encounter between these two. The circumstances make it impossible for him to look at her as the flat surface he was seeing before. If he had looked at her originally as a real human being, he could never have assaulted her. It also makes it impossible for her to look at him as the flat surface that she saw before. And therefore, the recognition of each by the other automatically comes forth. They encounter each other as full human beings. Now, that's the theory here about what produces a recognition shift. The way it's expressed here is that the recognition dimension on the second page, in the middle of the page, when the full different reality of the other party surfaces and emerges in full living three-dimensional form, it is profoundly powerful for the listening party. It can't be dismissed because it's a real thing. Any more than I can say there's not a cup on that table. No, it's impossible to say there's not a cup because it's there. It's impossible to say Brad is a jerk because that's not all he is, even if he is a little bit. It's not who Brad is. Brad is Brad. There's no even caption that I can put on him. He's a full human being. That's what a recognition shift, that's what calls forth a recognition shift. Until that time, when I see, oh, there's a whole three-dimensional depth to this person, I can treat them as an object, meaning I can be alienated, I can stick with myself and forget about them. Now, what are the things that mediators can do to help that emerge in a conversation, as opposed to in this encounter that we just saw? The answer is some of the very same things that help to support recognition shifts, although they work a little differently to support some of the same things that help to support empowerment shifts, but they work a little differently to support recognition shifts. So, for example, when a mediator helps people to say exactly what it is that they want to say, how they want to say it, instead of filtering language, controlling anger. When I support parties, each party's speaking, expressing themselves, finding their own voice, that not only helps them to settle down and experience empowerment, but it helps them actually to present themselves more fully to the other person. It just brings them alive in the room. When their anger becomes real hearable anger, when their words, and by the way, anything that you do to translate someone's words in a mediation, nothing a mediator ever says, we've already seen this on many of these tapes, that filters the party's language, it's never as good as what the party said themselves. It's never as good. When Bernie Mayer says something about fairness or this or that, it's a ripoff. It's nothing like 50-50 is not fair. It's nothing like the reality of it at all. But when the mediator amplifies what the party has said, that eventually, especially when the other person has calmed down and is listening, that helps this to emerge as a full three-dimensional reality. So the way a mediator supports a recognition shift is by helping this three-dimensional reality emerge, by helping each party to present herself more fully and clearly and in 3D living color. And reflections do that. Summaries, we said before, let people make choices about what they want to talk about. Summaries also, especially when they sharpen difference, they point out the real difference that people have, also begin to confront people with the different reality of another person's life. Ultimately, a summary is like saying to Elizabeth and Julie, for you, Elizabeth, this is a deeply disturbing experience that cuts to the core of your whole life as a black woman in America. And in some ways, therefore, you can't even begin to talk about it. But if you do, it's never going to be anything but angry. And that's what an argument about a purple house is about for you. And for you, Julie, this whole thing is about wanting to help somebody become a part of your community and being slapped in the face for doing it and not knowing how to help and being utterly rejected and feeling like, what did you do to deserve it? So on the one side, this is a reality of deep pain at lifelong oppression, not only for yourself, but your family and friends and whole community. And for you, this is like an experience of personal human rejection when all you're trying to do is to help. And that's a deeply disturbing thing. I mean, the very same experience for you is part of one reality for you, Elizabeth, and another reality. You're living in two different worlds. And that is always true in conflicts. It is almost always true, no matter how trivial the conflict is, that ultimately the people are in conflict because they're living in two different worlds. As the two different worlds emerge, and the fuller they are, I mean, we can think about this in many different ways. The movie is a good version of this. So is... Anybody read science fiction in here? Science fiction? No? No science fiction? Huh? A little tiny bit. Oh, it's not a good analogy. Star Trek. Everybody sees Star Trek, right? Okay. And Star Trek is often, the theme of Star Trek is often, you know, they show up on this quote-unquote alien world, right? Where these people look like monsters, right? And they have these customs and behaviors that are absolutely seemingly savage and obscene and everything else. And on the other hand, to those people, the Star Trek guys look like, you know, invaders coming in with some nefarious purpose. And all of this stuff happens, right? And then as the thing winds, you know, after an hour and several commercials, it turns out that there's a whole understandable reality to this monstrous, obscene culture, alien planet, that makes sense. And that the Star Trek people, of course, we always knew who they were. And that they realize these are two different worlds coming together. And that it's possible. That's how many episodes of Star Trek is that the theme of? It's like an ongoing theme. It's an ongoing theme in lots of movies, lots of literature, lots of ethnic wars. The war in Rwanda was Star Trek without a happy ending. The war in the Middle East is Star Trek without a happy ending. The war in Kosovo is Star Trek without a happy ending. A lot of these things don't have happy endings because the recognition never emerges. Why is that? That's an interesting question, huh? But that's the same thing, two different realities. So what can a mediator do? A mediator can use the same methods, basically, because they also support recognition shifts. Now, I want to look at, before we run out of time, how this mediator in the Purple House tape does that. Now, we've seen a lot of this, but we haven't seen, I don't know if we actually, how far did we watch this last week? I can't remember. Did we watch the whole end of the thing? I don't think so, did we? You'll tell me. Okay, mute. That has to change. But this takes about 15 minutes. So let's watch the end of this. This, by the way, is edited, so it's not the full version that's in your book, but most of it is there. And then I want to talk about some of the details.
Communities are almost there. The
now, this is just picking up where Elizabeth is agreeing
willing to,
go to the board.
Be pleasantly surprised.
But, she says, she's going to be surprised, but she's deciding to do this in a calm, cool, collected way.
Know that
what's
I
missing here is a little tiny bit where Julie says, now that we've done that, there's another issue I wanted to talk about. What issue do you think that is?
Breach.
Elizabeth has been putting it off, right? And now here's Elizabeth's response, which really brings it up to you.
I think that's such a challenge that it takes, it's wearying, I mean, the challenge of dealing with racism in America. And in one easy sentence or two, we're going to correct it and make everything all right. And it's just not so easy. And the pain that it inflicts and it's just not like, okay, why this community is quite what? It's got to be at least, what, 15 or 20 years old, even older than that.
I want you to think about what are the recognition shifts that they each made in this last segment of the tape, and what are the things that Bush is doing that help you, if anything?
And why does someone have to accuse Julie of being what she is, a racist?
I know that.
She comes and says, oh, very conciliatory. Yes, yes, we can make the board diverse now.
Do you enjoy living in a racist society? It sounds like you're trying to perpetuate it.
No.
Sounds like when somebody reaches out to you, the thought that something might change is so traumatic that you don't want to have anything to do with it.
It's easier
to just accuse people.
No. Julie, reaching out is when you move in next door and somebody knocks on your door and says, welcome. Reaching out is when you move in the neighborhood and you say, you know, we've got this monthly meeting that we have. Would you come? Reaching out is inviting us to the table, not being forced to invite us to the table, not because somebody calls you a racist, but then you say, oh, I feel so bad. Somebody called me a racist. I've got a son-in-law who's black. Oh, well, I tell you what we'll do. We'll get other people in the community, other black people, and therefore you've reached out to me? Come on. And you want to solve it in 10 easy lessons or 2 sentences with a mediator? You can't.
What is Julie's expression showing right now? You watching? You got to watch the screen, or you miss it. What is Julie's expression? As Elizabeth is saying what she's just said, what is Julie's expression showing? Frustration? Anybody else see anything else there? Can you read that any other way? Just like we were reading film on Crash. Can we read this any other way? Adam?
Yes, right. In the sense that she recognizes the fact that racism is deep-seated in her, I guess, post-hoc peace offering is not good enough.
Okay. Or some... Michelle?
It seems almost like she's trying to shut her out. She's just like, I can't believe we're going down this road again. Almost covering her ears a little bit so she can gather her own thoughts.
Okay. Okay. Now, it's possible to combine some of your reacts, right? I'm sorry, Yishan?
I was going to say that, just like in the movie scene, there's always some ambiguity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably a combination of frustration and listening. So you could say, I thought this was frustration, but you could also see it as deep listening, the complete opposite of frustration.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And maybe it's a little bit of both.
Brad?
I think frustration is definitely it, but I also think she's... You know, at a passe, she doesn't know what she could possibly do to convince this woman she is not a racist. That's what it looks like to me. You know, if I can't use my words, then what am I, you know?
So what I want you to do is I want you to learn to see things. It's easier for us, it's interesting, it's easier for us to interpret, we can't, these expressions are always ambiguous, okay? Try to see the recognition-oriented interpretation, which would be some version of a combination of Adam and Michelle's thoughts. That is, and part of what you said, Ishai, that Elizabeth is saying this, and she starts rubbing her face, taking her glasses off, as if to say, wow, this is an amazing, I don't really understand this, but this is like something new that I didn't heard of. Reaching out means this, reaching out means that. This is something new, different. What am I supposed to say to this? But I'm taking it seriously. I'm not shutting it out. In other words, instead of shutting it out, yes, I'm thinking what I'm going to say, but I'm actually attending to this. It's affecting me. I'm allowing myself to be affected by it. And that is itself a kind of recognition shift. Okay?
I'm 400 years of racism in 5 minutes. I'm not so
secure. Hang on.
Well, we'll get other people in the community, other black people, and therefore you reached out to me? Come on! And you want to solve it in 10 easy lessons or two sentences with a mediator? You cannot cure 400 years of racism in 5 minutes.
Everybody hear what you just said? Now you know where this ends up, or you should anyway, if you've read the whole case. What did you just say? You can't cure racism you can't cure 400 years of racism in 5 easy steps or 5 minutes with a mediator. That's what she's saying right here. There's still quite a bit of discussion left to go here. But you hear her say that? And keep that in mind as we watch the way this continues.
I saw a cure in 5 minutes. I'm trying to take a step. A little teeny tiny step.
You have taken the little teeny tiny step, okay? You've taken it, okay?
Now be good.
You have taken the tiny little step. Thank you. Thank you.
Oh, please.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry, but this is too much.
So this, maybe this is a discussion that you really can't have.
Clearly not.
Or that you don't want to have.
It just cannot be resolved so easily.
And it might be just worthwhile to, in terms of what,
there's a gap
sort of someone saying over here, here's you saying, that in terms of this larger issue of racism, relation between white and black, black and white, that apart from the feelings, not that that's not necessarily that a major part of it, but that what, in terms of your word was healing, Elizabeth, that you may have different ideas about what that takes, what that means, what that would take. Your comment was, first you have to make it, you have to admit to what the situation is, or, for example, you were saying what that means, reaching out means coming over and knocking on the door, it means this.
Before we get here, yes.
Right, well,
yes,
whatever
yes,
stage.
Before one compels you to do that, yes.
Right, okay, and Julie, you're saying that in terms of what it means to talk about that your suggestion of addressing the issue or listening to Elizabeth's comment about the lack of diversity on the board, that whatever else happened before, acknowledging that now and
she's right.
And responding to it, what I hear you saying from your side is that the way you see that is it's not because you want to feel good, but because you acknowledge that, as you just said, she's right.
She's right. There are no African Americans or Asians or Hispanics on the board.
She's
right.
So what you're saying is,
and we should
separate from how you feel, she's right and that situation is wrong.
Right. Yes, I am saying that. I didn't use that word, but yes, I am.
Going anywhere else?
I can think of lots of ways to address the issue of diversity in our community. But if I'm going to be met every time with, I don't want to make you feel good, this isn't about you, and rejection of those ideas, then it's very hard to have the conversation.
No. And this is all I did.
Hang on. Now, do you see this different reality emerging here? I'm just trying to help, and I'm being rejected. Okay? Versus, I'm telling you that there's 400 years of pain and suffering here that can't change so quickly. Right? These are two, and are both of those plausible human experiences? Plausible realities? Right? So, what is the mediator doing here? I mean, we have, what is the mediator doing here that might or that helps that to emerge?
I was just going to add, it's not only how, you know, it's how they interpret the other two is completely different. You're just being stubborn and you want to maintain the situation. You just want to feel better about yourself. So
That's true, Yishai. But of course, as long as that's true, a recognition shift is unlikely to occur, right? So what counteracts that? What counteracts that negative interpretation is the emergence of a positive, plausible reality.
That's what makes that picture fade and something else become much more prominent, much more recognizable. When do you offer recognition? When something is there that becomes recognizable, right? So what does the mediator do here, if anything, of what we just saw? What does the mediator do that's helpful in beginning to see those pictures emerge? Anything? Can you identify anything the mediator does? Ashley?
Let me check that at one point I asked the parties or suggesting that maybe this is something, maybe this is a conversation that you can't have right now.
Right, so he actually allows them to choose whether to continue to have this very, very difficult exchange or not. Right? In the same way that the cop in Crash allows her to choose, is it okay if I reach across your lap? So the mediator, again, reinforces their choice about whether to go ahead with this. Is there anything else that he does that corresponds to what we just talked about in terms of some of the things a mediator can do? Reflection, summary. What is that intervention that we just saw? How would you characterize that? What we spoke about? Yeah.
As a reflection, you are amplifying what Julie was saying.
And Elizabeth, right?
And Elizabeth.
What you're saying is that, you know, from your point of view, in a certain sense, it was a reflection folded into a summary. You disagree about what healing means and how you do it. And you're saying, first, it means that you have to admit that there's a problem, which we didn't see that in this clip, that Elizabeth says. And secondly, you mean that it means real reaching out is like this, and not waiting till somebody drags you into mediation, right? And on the other hand, yeah.
I'm just wondering.
Just 1 second. Could you hold your thought. The mediator repeats that, reflects that. What's the impact of that on recognition? What impact might that have on recognition, meaning Julie's recognition of Elizabeth's separate reality? How might that help? Yeah, Marianne?
It allows her to see what Elizabeth is actually saying. Instead of just hearing the yelling or the anger, she's hearing, oh, she has maybe a different way of looking at this, but this is how she's looking.
She begins to hear someone who, given the background of her life experience and her constant experience of rejection, you know, it would have taken more than just sort of, you know, waiting for her to come to us for her to feel welcomed. Reaching out doesn't mean now in the mediation. It should have happened long ago. That's what she needs. That's what her reality is. So Julie, the mediator's reflection helps Julie to hear Elizabeth. It helps Elizabeth to present herself more fully, and then because she's presented herself more fully, how is Julie going to say, no, that doesn't make any sense? She can't say it, because it does make sense, right? On the other hand, what Julie is saying, which is, you know, every time I try to say I'm going to help you, slap me in the face. What must that be like? And as she said, and which the mediator also is reflected, Elizabeth begins to reconsider. Right, well, I guess that may be what that feels like. So it becomes harder for me to reject this person. You know what I'm saying?
I was just saying, I was wondering whether really the topic would even come up if it wasn't something neutral reflecting what was, you know, being said, if you would have even gotten as far in the conversation, because it's just, I think that you would be talking in stumbling blocks. You wouldn't have really gotten into that topic because you would have never gotten past step one. So.
I think that's a very good observation. And in any event, whether or not you would have gotten, what you wouldn't have come to at this stage, what you wouldn't have gotten to this stage if they hadn't gone through that whole, in some ways, stupid and irrelevant discussion about the house and the color and the board. Because by making all those decisions and moving at their own pace, they established enough strength on each side and sort of realizing, because each one of them realized during that whole discussion about the house that, oh, this person is not completely off the wall. This person is not completely unreasonable. This person is someone who you can talk to. So by all the time that occurs, then when Julie again brings up the question of race, what's the difference here from the entire rest of the session,
Elizabeth doesn't say, no, I don't want to talk about it. She decides to engage in talking about it. And that itself is an act of recognition. She's talking with a woman, just like it was an act of recognition for the woman in the car to allow the racist assaulter to save her, right? This is the equivalent of that. Elizabeth's willingness to have this conversation is the equivalent of the woman's willingness to allow this white cop to come into some sort of engagement with her. She doesn't want him. She doesn't want anybody like him. And neither does Elizabeth until now.
Section 2. It's not that you're suddenly saying...
Oh. It's always hard to get this at the right place. It's
not that you're suddenly saying... Oh, yes, that's a good idea. Let's make it.
Sorry. Okay.
I don't want to make you feel good. This isn't about you and rejection of those ideas. Then it's fair.
Look at how Elizabeth is looking at Julie now. Again, if you look at how she's looking, we've seen throughout this tape that when Elizabeth looks, if you look at the way she's looking while Julie is talking, it usually is disgusted, angry, you know, like... I'm repulsed by being even listening to this woman. What does this look like just right now? What's the expression on Elizabeth's face? By the way, who is she looking at, Julie? You see her looking at Julie? You see the sight line? She's looking right at her. And she's listening to her. That's called recognition. She hasn't really looked at her much during this mediation, except when she's been shouting at her. And whenever Julie is looking at her and speaking, Elizabeth is looking down or looking away. This is a real difference in sight line.
Very hard to have the conversation. No. And this is all I take exception to. Not that you're suddenly saying, oh, yes, that's a good idea. Let's make it more diverse. But to dare to say, in the one hand, oh, I'm not racist. Oh, no. I like the diversity. As long as we're in our place.
And that's not what I'm
saying. No, I don't mean
your language.
It is.
And you are imputing it to me.
Exactly. I am. But if you had, if 7 years ago, Julie was a worker or of the mind, I am going to make this community in all ways as diverse as I can possibly make it. And you had opposition. I can understand it. But for you to dare come in here and in one or two sentences say, oh, yes, let's take steps. And I'm supposed to be what? Placated? Well, I'm not.
Not placated.
Work with you?
Let's make it better.
Fine. No. Fine. But do you see my point?
Yes.
Hang in there. Imperfect editing.
Yeah. Okay. Me. See you.
Can I ask you just a question? I'm not sure whether this will clarify anything or not, but in the way you're describing the questions that you're asking, one of the implications that I'm hearing is when you use a term like racist in this context.
Now, what does Julie's expression say in those last few minutes? What would you be doing if you were Julie?
What would you imagine Julie would do, or some other person in Julie's shoes? What might they do at this point? Huh? No, not what is she doing right now. What might some other person do as this conversation has just come up now?
What
would
she do?
Huh?
Leave.
Forget it. I mean, look, okay. I mean, and she's had several opportunities, right, to do that, to walk out, right? So what is the fact that she's sitting there and she's, like you said, Brad, she's thinking, right? Why? Why is she thinking? What does her thinking represent? What does it say? If you have to put a caption, a bubble over her head, like we did with the film, what does the caption read? What does the bubble read? Pardon me?
She recognizes
what does the bubble say? The thought in her mind, what does it say? She has to speak in Judy's voice. Yeah?
How do I make this better?
What else? She has a point. What else?
This is hard to hear.
Right.
Huh? This is not easy to hear.
This is not easy to hear. Right. I understand where you're coming from. See, all of these statements are
statements that say, what? I'm trying to understand you better and not to see you just as someone, you know, playing the race card and trying to make me feel guilty. I am trying to understand you not as a cartoon character, but as a real human being. And that is what recognition means, right? And it's hard. But she's trying. That is a recognition shift. That is the movement, the gesture towards someone else.
Well, one of the things you mean by it is if you're living in a multiracial community, but participating in a management structure, a power structure that excludes everybody but one group, then whether or not there's an intention behind that or not, it's discriminatory. It's, in your word, racist. It excludes. I'm not sure I'm getting there. But it's sort of,
In Julie's particular case,
I'm just trying to understand.
In Julie's particular case, because I don't want to, as a mediator, give you this definition of racism. No. I don't think that's an exclusion. It's certainly an exclusion that is questionable. Why is that exclusion taking place in a diverse community? Why? I mean, often people say things, it's all my fault. Really, I'm really not only addressing the committee and the board. I'm not holding you accountable for the committee and the board totally. There are several incidences in the community, the committee and the board totally.
What's that? Elizabeth says that. What's that? Recognition, isn't it? Compared to everything that she set up until now. I'm not holding you totally accountable for the committee and the board. That's a big step. You're not as bad as I've said. I'm not holding you responsible for everything here.
There are several incidences in the community, some of which I have named, that you have indeed, I feel, not that have been racist. That some of your actions, and I have
worried
what, and your deeds have been racist, specifically. So, now, you sit here at the table with a mediator, and you say, I'm trying to take a step to correct the situation. And my daughter has said, that's great. Take the step. Do what you need to do. You've said you can't elect to the committee, you're not on the election, but you're going to take steps to make it more diverse. Do what you can. And I'm saying to you, for the reason that I haven't turned on a dime and said, oh, thank you, great, is because you've been here 8 years. And what has it taken for you to make those steps? Has your heart been open in the 8 years? Yes, you moved into this community because you wanted diversity. What, to say you lived in a diverse, multiracial community? Multiracial diversity to me means some kind of interaction. It doesn't mean staying secular or integrated within your own separate group. It doesn't mean the board, after 18 years of a community existing, that is still all white board, that is still an all white committee, that all the committees that function in this. Come on!
What you're saying is that's not, you're not ready to let go of, and you can't let go of the feelings that you have, that you've expressed here today, that probably have
not so, they're not going to be so easy.
Not so easy, right?
It's not going to be, oh, I'm on the committee, oh, I'm on the board, oh, no problem, no.
Right. And Julie, I mean, you sat here and been going through this discussion, which isn't all that easy discussion to have. This has been.
How did Julie look right now? Let me just ask before we hear what Julie says. What do you think Elizabeth wants Julie to say?
You're right.
You're right about what? What she wanted to say. Julie's already said, I'll try to work for diversity. Julie's already said, we made mistakes in the past. What does she want Julie to say? What has she said several times? We haven't seen that many
races.
Anything else she wants to say? Right? Okay. She might. Julie's already said that in lesser ways. You're right, there's no diversity on the board, and that's wrong. Right? Anything more specific Elizabeth wants to hear Julie say?
For discussion. Yeah, obviously, because you brought
what Julie
up
says.
And you wanted to talk through some of this. I don't know what your thoughts are about where the discussion is at this point and how you feel about what's come out, whether you think that that's added to your clarity in the situation, your understanding of it, and what Elizabeth's views of this are. Has that accomplished some of what you wanted to in having the discussion? And do you?
I can't say there was.
Look at Elizabeth and Bernice right now. What's different about where they are right now than where they've been up till this moment in the mediation? You see something different there? Yeah.
They're leaning forward.
This is the first time you see them listen in this way, almost, to this entire thing. Although it's been moving towards this, but this is very different, right? Right? And and Elizabeth has been saying, what is the major thing that Elizabeth is saying that she wants Julie to understand? What do you think, apart from, I want you to understand that you're racist? And going back, do you remember I asked you, what? That it can't be fixed. Remember I stopped the tape before and I said, when this whole thing just started, remember this, right? When Elizabeth first starts speaking, she says, I just want you to understand it can't be fixed so quickly. You can't fix 400 years of racism with five easy steps or 5 minutes with a mediator. And she's repeated that throughout this whole discussion. She even repeated it when the first time this came up, and she said, let's go back to the house because you can't cure 400 years of racism in a mediation.
Such clear intention in having it. I do hear Elizabeth saying that there's 400 years of discrimination and that one gesture, or 8 years in a community, whichever number you want to use, and one gesture doesn't fix everything. And I appreciate that. Of course it doesn't. I guess I just wish that, although it doesn't put everything to rest, I felt like you were willing to be open to this anyway, or instead of just questioning my motives and dismissing. That's what I
mean. Think what an amazingly clear statement that is now on Julie's part of both what she understands Elizabeth has said and what she now wants. And this is the prelude.
I am a woman of God.
This is the prelude to Elizabeth's acceptance.
And I am a woman of God. And as much as I may disagree with you, I don't want to leave you hurt.
Okay. You're a racist. I haven't changed my position on that. And it's a racist place. But I can extend my hand to you. Why can I extend my hand? Because you understood what I was saying. And I can see that you understood what I was saying. So this is where, without, it's no huge big deal. But the fact that Julie actually said that, isn't that kind of an astonishing thing? She got what Elizabeth was saying better than I did, better than you did. You read it. But Julie was sitting there in real time, and she got what Elizabeth was saying and says, okay, I get what you're saying. This is what you're saying. And I just wish that I didn't have to feel like you were slapping me in the face. Whereupon Elizabeth says, I don't want to slap you in the face. So the exchange of recognition grows through this whole last part. Now, we didn't really talk that's analyzed specifically what the mediator did to do this. But all the mediator does really is to lift up the things that they're saying so each one can express herself more clearly and list back the mediator to express herself. As to how she feels having had this conversation, this experience. Oh, we don't have to put words in people's mouth. They have all those words. All we have to do is sort of help catch them as they come out and not let them just fall on the ground. And the result is that people then see each other, recognize each other from a foundation of strength. Okay, we will continue this next week. I didn't have time and you didn't stop me to give you my story, but I'll tell you afterwards. Okay? All right, I will look forward to seeing your papers Saturday night. Saturday, Brad, not Sunday night, Saturday at 11:59. And I don't know if I can promise that I'll have them all back by next week, but I'll do my best. And I do hope to see you all here next week. And, you know, maybe I'll even have a little surprise for you. Oh, I wonder what that might be. Maybe not. Are you going to send me a... Oh, yes, you were. Okay. All right. I'm a patient man. All right. Do you want to hear this now? Or I... Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, I may... you're going to set up in here now?
No, I'm just going to take your recording.
I'll take your recording. Go ahead. Take my recording, please.
You got it.